everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani at IE Green on the Progressive Radio Network. And I hope you all had a wonderful, wonderful holiday. I know I certainly did. I got to be surrounded with my family and friends. You know, traditionally in our family, as a Jewish family, we take a backseat to our claim to the actual day of Christmas. And since so many in our family's partners are Christian, we bow down and let them go and be with those families. So we celebrated on Saturday our family holiday, Christmas, and we all got together. Since Hanukkah is 8 days, there's no way you can get together on that. So you have to pick one day anyway when everyone comes together. So we all got together on Saturday, and it was really, really delightful. And then on Sunday, you all know last week, you know, I served the homeless. You know, I've been doing it for 23 years. And last Tuesday, we served everybody at Rufus King Park. We served over 500 people, plus made enough food for probably another 500 for the River Fund food pantry to take around to different shelters that they work with. But on Sunday, Community Solidarity, which is an organization I really want to just take a moment to tell you about. It's just an amazing organization. They do a huge, huge food share in Hempstead every Sunday at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, right outside between the bus station and the train station. And it's just an amazing, amazing thing. They collect all week long food every day from so many different places. 6 days a week, they're in different locations. And you can find them online at communitysolidarity.org and see where the locations are. But every Saturday at 3 o'clock, they're in Bed-Stuy on the corner of right by Von King and Tompkins Park. And then the other days they're on Long Island, and on Sundays they're in Hempstead, and they collect thousands and thousands of pounds of food. And I have to say, the majority is organic. They get so much from Trader Joe's and Whole Foods. They're, you know, really committed to veganism, more from a sustainability standpoint. I mean, we all know the downside of meat production on our planet. I mean, the greenhouse gas emissions coming out of meat production is higher than, you know, all the cars. I mean, and it's a conversation most of us don't like to have because so many people really love their meat, even if they're environmentalists and don't really want to look at it. So, so this organization, you know, they don't serve any meat. So mostly it's fresh fruits and vegetables. And that's what is missing when a lot of these people who get food regularly from food pantries, it's the fresh fruit and produce that's missing. So they give bags and bags to everybody. You don't have to be a member. There's no paperwork. No one cares about your status. The main philosophy is that food is a right for everybody. And so they give out so much food. And before the holidays, they also collected coats. I did a big coat collection, you know, which I did for my group in Rufus King Park with the River Fund. But then I wasn't able to collect all the coats that people had gotten for me. So I got some more coats and brought them down on Sunday to the Hempstead share. And it was just amazing. They had toys and coats and food and happy people. Just really, it's amazing. And, you know, we all need to step up to the plate. And I talk about this so much. And lately, with what's going on in our country, you know, I talk about it in terms of becoming more active citizens politically, which is not something that I used to really talk about much. But, you know, with the tax bill and with the cuts to the EPA and with the Center for Disease Control not being able to say transgender or fetus, and I mean, these new rules that are coming up, I mean, I feel like we're going to be living in a military state if we don't step up to the plate and do something. And I really mean we all need to step up to the plate, because the only power we have is the power of the people. I mean, we cannot fight the money that these corporations have, that they, you know, throw down to Trump and give to his campaign so that, you know, he's just, you know, he's so about creating laws and rules that benefit the very wealthy and the big corporations that are supporting him. And we have the power of the people, and we have to really come together, and everybody, and I really mean everybody, whether it's you, whether you're writing letters, calling your congressmen, showing up at protests. Last week, actually a couple of weeks ago now, my daughter got arrested down in Washington. She went down and laid her body down in front of a senator's office. You know, this is before the tax bill vote. But, you know, just showing up. It's just really important that we all do. Rise and Resist is a wonderful organization that is resisting everything. So you can really just plug in with them and find it, what it is that you're passionate about, and, you know, choose those rallies to go to. But there's so much that we can all do, and we can all do together. And we can only do it if we really make that commitment and show up. But anyway, just another plug for Community Solidarity. Check them out online. You know, you can show up as a volunteer, or you can show up as a person to get some groceries, whichever side of the volunteering or organization you want to participate in, it's there for you. So do check that out. You can sign up on Facebook too. They have a great Facebook page. Coming up in the New York, Long Island area, the Long Island Agricultural Forum out in Suffolk Community College is having their annual forum, which is a two-day educational conference, networking opportunities, trade show for anyone interested in agriculture here on Long Island. And it starts on January 10th, 7:30 in the morning, and it goes for 2 days. So check that out if that interests you. Also from the 10th through the 12th, the Nature Connection Leadership Conference is going on with Wild Earth. And that's up in the Hudson Valley. And Wild Earth is a nonprofit that runs nature-based programs for teens, children, families, and adults. And this time they're collaborating with other school leaders and groups to bring together this program, connecting schools to the local economy and regenerative businesses. So it sounds like a really wonderful conference. It's January 10th through the 12th. It's at the LifeBridge Sanctuary in Rosendale, New York. All of these events, by the way, are on my website at IE Green. So if you would like, you can join in with those. I have a cooking class coming up on January 13th at the IE Green Homestead. It will be a vegan cooking class, really geared for working people who want to be able to make food and freeze it and then be able to take it out at another time. So we'll be making a couple different casseroles, my vegan moussaka, a vegan lasagna, a Japanese stir fry. So you can sign up for that. Also, on January 15th, I am doing a cooking class at the Westbury Library. And that is also going to be, it's more of a demonstration than a hands-on experience, but we'll be making a vegetable jambalaya and a vegetable curry quinoto, which is similar to risotto, but instead of making it with risotto, we make it with quinoa. And of course, this one is a vegetable curry, so it's more of an Indian coconut curry flavor. Anyway, that's on Monday, January 15th from 7 to 8:30. You can register at the library's website or call them at 516-333-0176. On January 17th, Molloy College has their Sustainable Film Series, which is a wonderful ongoing series that they have where they screen different films that are all focused on the environment and food and doing really good things. So this one is called Food Evolution, and it looks at the world and the situation we're facing right now with our food. So it's a very good film. You know, it discusses GMOs on all different levels. They also have a vegan dinner beforehand. They ask for a $5 donation, but if you don't even have that, you can come in free. And it's out at the Molloy College Suffolk Center, which is out by the Republic Airport in Farmingdale. And following the film, they always have a very lively discussion. So that's worthwhile. And again, that's January 17th. And then January 19th through the 21st is the NOFA New York Winter Conference, which is a really great conference. It brings all the farmers who are, you know, have the time off in the winter out, and everybody comes together really looking for a good time. It's all weekend long. I will be doing a cooking demo there on Friday, January 19th. So I hope you can make it to that. And I'll be doing a demonstration of a Japanese stir fry with rice noodles, also a mixed vegetable and a coconut curry sauce, and also a Mediterranean vegetable with fire roasted tomatoes, olives, and capers. And so I'll be demonstrating that. And I really would love to see some friendly faces there in the audience. But it's a great conference. You know, there's great activities at night. There's films, there's contra dancing, there's music. All the food's donated by the local farmers. And it's just really a wonderful thing. So I hope you come out to that. I have more things on my website, but I don't want to take the time right now because I still want to share my recipe with all of you. And then invite my guest. My guest this week is Sherry Torkus, and she's a holistic pharmacist, and I'll be telling you more about her in just a minute. But first, I want to share with you my recipe. This week, I am sharing with you a gluten-free, dairy-free pecan chocolate biscotti. And I realize I probably should have shared this with you before the holidays, but you still have New Year's, so you can make them for New Year's. And they're really unbelievably delicious. You wouldn't know that they're any different than any other biscotti, but they're really, really good. So to make the dough, you need 6 tablespoons coconut oil, and you can double this recipe easily too, which I think is worth doing since you're going to all this work. Why not make enough for everybody? But anyway, 6 tablespoons coconut oil, 2/3 cup of granulated organic sugar, 1/4 teaspoon of salt, 1.5 teaspoons of baking powder, 2 teaspoons vanilla extract, 6 tablespoons of water, and 2 tablespoons of flax seed, ground flax seed. Then you need 2 cups of gluten-free flour. I use Pamela's gluten-free flour. It's the bread mix. She has 2 different ones. One is a baking one that has some dairy in it, so I don't use that. So it's a 2 cups of their gluten-free bread mix, or you can use whatever your favorite gluten-free flour is. 3 tablespoons of fair trade cocoa powder. The Dutch process is preferred. 1.5 cups of ground pecans. 1/2 cup of organic fair trade chocolate chips. I use the mini ones. I like those better in the biscotti because they're not that big a cookie. 2 tablespoons of powdered sugar for sprinkling on top. And again, I use organic powdered sugar. So you're going to preheat your oven to 350 and lightly grease or line a cookie sheet with parchment paper. And then in a medium-sized bowl, you're going to beat the coconut oil, the sugar, the salt, the vanilla, and the baking powder until the mixture is smooth and creamy. And in a separate bowl, you're going to just dilute the ground flax seeds with the water and mix that up and just let it sit for a little while and become more glutinous. And you're adding that back into the mixture. And that's your egg substitute. And I use that a lot as an egg substitute, flaxseed with water. Sometimes I'll also add a little apple cider and vinegar, but I didn't this time. So at a low speed of your mixer, add the gluten-free flour, stirring until smooth, and the dough will be sticky. And that's what you want. And then you're going to add the pecans, the ground pecans to that. Divide the dough in half, leaving half of the dough in the bowl and placing half of the dough on the cookie sheet that's lined with the parchment paper. And it's about 1.5 cups that you're taking out, and you're about 1.5 cups is remaining in the bowl. You're going to shape the dough on the pan into a log size shape that's about 14 inches long and about 4 inches wide. And straighten the log out, pressing down so that it's smooth on top. Then you're going to add the cocoa powder to the remaining dough that's in the bowl and stir that up and combine that till it's all combined, mixed in well. Then stir in the chocolate chips. And then using your fingers, wet them with a little water so that the dough doesn't stick to them. Spread the chocolate dough on top of the vanilla dough log shape. So it's the same. So you're basically, you know, making a blanket of the chocolate dough now on top of the vanilla dough. And you're going to press that down so that the two doughs kind of come together but stay separate in color. And then you're going to place the dough, bake the dough for 25 minutes in a 350 oven. And then you're going to remove it from the oven, reduce the temperature now to 325, and let the pan cool for like 20 minutes. And you can lift the biscotti off of the cookie sheet now for, and put it onto a cutting board. And you're going to slice the dough using a serrated knife or a sharp chef knife, and cut it on the diagonal so that they're, you know, a nice pretty shape. And then you're going to spread the biscotti out, put it back on the baking sheet. You can use a clean piece of parchment paper if you cut through this one, and turn the biscotti now on their side. So you're baking them on their side, and you're going to bake for another 30 minutes. And then remove the biscotti from the oven and just let them cool. And as they cool, they'll continue to dry and become that crunchy, beautiful biscotti that you know and love to dip into your tea or coffee. And you can sprinkle them also with the confectioner sugar on top if you choose to. And this recipe makes about 24 biscotti. So if you're doubling it, you will have about 48. So enjoy them. Of course, I love feedback. So if you do make them, let me know how they turned out. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to all of you my guest. Sherry Torkos is a holistic pharmacist, and she's also an author and a certified fitness instructor and health enthusiast, and she loves sharing her passion with others. She graduated from the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science in 1992 and has been practicing holistic pharmacy in the Niagara region of Ontario ever since. And her philosophy of practice is to integrate conventional and complementary therapies to optimize health and prevent disease. I'm so excited to have Sherry on because, you know, as you, most of you who listen to me know, you know, I'm not a big enthusiast when it comes to the pharmaceutical companies. And so Sherry's, you know, really doing it in a different way. And so I'm really thrilled to introduce you to her. Sherry, are you with me?
I am. Hi there. Thanks so much for having me.
You're so welcome. I'm so, like I said, really happy to have you on because I'm pretty cynical when it comes to pharmaceutical companies. My sister even works for a pharmaceutical company, and I just, you know, I just feel like so often they're pushing drugs and, you know, and not necessarily doing what's best for people's health. It's, you know, gets into all about the profit and all that. So it's really nice to have you on and to have you share your philosophy and how you do it a little differently. So Can you just share with us a little bit first about your history and how you got into holistic pharmacy?
Sure. You know, and I can totally understand your skepticism and concerns about the interests of pharmaceutical companies and profits versus the benefit of people. I think that's a concern a lot of people have. Myself, when I was, I guess, a young teenager, I started volunteering in our local hospital, and that was my introduction to pharmacy. And I really enjoyed working in the hospital environment, helping sick people. I found it fascinating that there were all these different medications that could do all of these wonderful things in terms of helping to save lives and help people with serious illnesses. And so I decided that I would pursue a career in pharmacy. And I went to school in Philadelphia, had a fabulous education. It was like the best pharmacy school where all of the fathers of pharmacy had, you know, they actually started the profession at the Philadelphia College of Pharmacy and Science back in the 1800s. And
really?
So a really strong heritage. Yeah, the school was founded by McNeil from the Tylenol company and Burroughs and Welcome and Rohr and all of these fathers of pharmacy. And so a very strong heritage at the school and great learning environment. You know, I have to say, even though I went to school back in the late 80s, they were very progressive back then in talking more about the importance of patient education and at the time, we even had elective courses in pharmacognosy, so we could learn about plants and medicinal herbs, and I took elective courses in nutrition. But it really wasn't until I started working and practicing as a pharmacist that I decided I wanted to, you know, focus more on the preventative and the holistic side of things. And that was primarily because I was seeing people that were coming into me and relying too much on pharmaceuticals, especially when faced with chronic conditions that really could be helped so dramatically by lifestyle interventions like blood pressure and diabetes and heart health and arthritis and a lot of things where I just was thinking that relying on these drugs is only going to help so much. And I just felt that this was something I could do. I was passionate about educating people on prevention and talking to them about their diet and supplements and exercise and all the things that I truly believed in. And so it was early on in my career in the early 90s where I really started to adopt this type of a practice. And it's been very rewarding. You know, people come to see me and they know that I'm passionate about natural medicine, and even doctors will come in and ask me for advice for themselves or their wives and helping to manage different health conditions. So it's been quite a journey. You know, certainly there have been obstacles along the way, and at times skepticism by the medical community about the role of natural medicine, even the credibility. But, you know, today we have so much, you know, really strong science coming out about benefits of various natural products that it's hard to discount that.
Absolutely. So you actually then trained to become a health coach?
Yes. So I'm not a health coach per se. I do that as in my role as a pharmacist. I talk to patients, you know, rather than just talking about how they should take their drugs and being compliant and talking just about the side effects and interactions. I like to sit down and talk to people about, you know, what foods they should add to their diet, maybe some changes that they should make in their lifestyle, you know, exercise, stopping smoking, managing stress, things like that. Because I you know, truly believe, and I'm sure you're on the same page as well, that all of these things, these lifestyle choices, make a big impact in your health.
Absolutely. And I know you focused a lot on food allergies as well. And that a lot of times food allergies, you know, or an intolerance that someone might have might just be your own body's deficiency. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so this topic is really relevant to me because I myself have celiac disease, and I suffered for over 10 years before I was diagnosed. And celiac, which is gluten intolerance, something that there's good awareness about today, but back when I was sick, this was the late 70s, early 80s, and the doctors didn't have any idea what was wrong with me, and I really suffered for a long time to the point that I experienced severe vitamin mineral deficiencies throughout my body because my digestive system was just so wrecked from eating gluten. I lost my hair. I was covered in eczema, lost my night vision, joint pain, headaches, depression. It was just a big, you know, disaster at that time. And finally, when it was discovered that I had celiac disease and I started the gluten-free diet, which in the 80s, it wasn't always easy to follow because there wasn't the options that we have today. I mean, today I was listening to your biscotti recipe that you gave out, and, you know, we can find gluten-free flour so readily.
Right.
Even restaurants. I mean, it's easy to be gluten-free today, but back then it wasn't so easy. So, yeah, I really learned firsthand about food intolerances and gluten intolerance, you know, something now that, again, there's good awareness. But another intolerance, which I have come to find out that I have, which doesn't seem to be good awareness about, is histamine intolerance. And histamine intolerance affects a lot of people. It can cause digestive symptoms like bloating, gas, upset stomach, but it can also cause racing heart, headache, tremors, difficulty sleeping, itchy, watery eyes, tissue swelling, a lot of the histamine type symptoms. And this is something that, again, I discovered that I had about a year ago. But I would say that I'm finding now that so many people are affected by this and just don't realize what it is.
What foods are involved in histamine intolerance? Like if somebody thinks they have it, how do you know to avoid it? What is it?
Yeah. So histamine is a chemical our body releases in response to allergic symptoms, but we can also ingest histamine through foods such as your aged meats and cheeses. Wine in particular, red wine, has very high amounts of histamine in it, but it's also found in white wine and champagne and beer. Your pickled vegetables, certain fruits have histamine as well. Nuts and even healthy things like kombucha and kefir and yogurt, there's histamine in those foods as well. And the problem isn't, the problem isn't so much histamine. It's that if you are taking in all this histamine from food and your body is not processing it, if you're not breaking it down, that's where the problem occurs. And in order for histamine to be broken down in your system, you need an enzyme called diamine oxidase, or DAO. And with people that have a deficiency of DAO, or they are taking just copious amounts of histamine and maybe medications that are affecting their DAO levels, that's when you can run into trouble. And so histamine intolerance, again, very common. The main reason why somebody would develop a histamine intolerance would be having a deficiency of this enzyme diamine oxidase. And if you think about it in the same way with lactose intolerance, a lot of people have heard of lactose intolerance. That occurs when you don't have enough of the enzyme lactase to break down lactose, milk sugar, and then you get the gas, the bloating, the diarrhea. And often people just opt to either avoid dairy or they take a lactase supplement before they have dairy.
Mm-hmm. So what would someone take if they have a histamine intolerance? Like what?
Yeah.
What?
Well, thankfully there is an enzyme you can take, which is great news, because to tell somebody, you know, give up your wine, your beer, your cheese, your meat.
What I'm thinking. Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's not going to happen. Right. I've been counseling people on foods and food intolerances and allergies for a long time. And I know that once you give an extensive list of somebody's favorite foods and say, yeah, try to give that up, it's just not going to happen. So a better strategy, more practical, is to take an enzyme before you have any high histamine foods. And the enzyme, so it's DAO, diamine oxidase. And the one that I take, it's by a company, it's called Umbrellex, Umbrellex DAO. And if you're looking online at supplements, just a word of caution, because there are some products that are promoted online to, you know, help with histamine intolerance, but they don't actually contain any diamine oxidase. So you need to read labels carefully. But the Umbrellex DAO, it's a food grade, medical grade supplement. You take it 15 minutes before you're having any histamine containing foods or beverages. And it basically it works locally in the digestive system to break down histamine. It's not absorbed into your bloodstream. You don't have to worry about any side effects or effects on your kidney or liver or other things, other medications even. So that's that is available now for people that have this histamine intolerance. So when we look at people that experience this problem, about 70% of people that have this histamine intolerance have a deficiency of diamine oxidase, or DAO. And this is something that has become much more prevalent over the past few decades, just like the prevalence of allergies in general. I mean, when we look at how common it is today for people to have celiac disease, gluten intolerance, wheat allergies, or other food allergies compared to 30, 40 years ago. I know when I was going to school as a child, there were no allergies in my whole school. And today, my son, who's 7, he has 4 kids in his class that have different allergies. So, you know, this is becoming more common, and researchers believe that there may be some environmental factors at play here. The fact that we eat so much processed food, we're ingesting so many chemicals, pesticides, and things in the environment, that we're under a lot of stress as well. That can affect your digestive system and your body's ability to produce diamine oxidase, because this enzyme is naturally produced by different cells in your digestive system. So if you're under stress, if you're eating a poor diet, you're getting a lot of toxins in your system, those are risk factors. Also, if you have a digestive condition such as celiac disease, like I have, if you have Crohn's, colitis, irritable bowel, leaky gut, all of these things increase your risk of having a histamine intolerance and a DAO deficiency. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is simply age. As we get older, this becomes more prevalent. And that's why, you know, people are often surprised that, you know, they could handle wine or beer in their 20s or 30s, but now they hit their 40s or 50s and they're like, what's going on? I go out for pizza and beer and I get red in the face. I have a headache. I'm bloated. I don't feel well. Or they're having, you know, wine and cheese and getting these symptoms. So it does become more prevalent with age.
Mm-hmm. And is there a test to diagnose whether someone has a histamine intolerance?
There are tests that can measure a person's blood levels of histamine as well. There are tests that can check your amounts of diamine oxidase. However, in talking to some of the leading authorities on this subject, the feeling is that the blood tests are not highly reliable. They don't always give you an accurate picture of what's happening in the body and how your system is actually responding. So the best way really to determine whether or not you have a histamine intolerance is to either do an elimination diet. So give up all foods that have histamine, high amounts of histamine, especially for a period of time and see if you feel better and then gradually reintroduce them in and see if that brings back the symptoms. Or you could do an enzyme trial. So take the enzymes before you eat the histamine foods, see if that helps. So before you have the red wine, the beer, the pizza, the cheese, meat, whatever it may be, take one of the diamine oxidase supplements about 15 minutes before. And if you feel better after and you're not getting the flushing, the headache, and the reaction, then that just indicates that your body just didn't have enough of the enzyme. For myself, that's what I did. I got the enzymes. I gave it a try. Couldn't believe the difference. I normally don't drink a lot, but I loved red wine. But I've noticed in my 40s, the red wine wasn't agreeing with me. I was getting flushing and a headache, and I couldn't sleep at night. I'd get racing heart, even after one glass. So when I found out about this issue, histamine intolerance, and I got some enzymes, and I gave it a try, and wow, big difference. So I can actually have my wine without suffering with the symptoms.
Uh-huh. Now, you said you take Umbralex. Yeah. And you're talking about online that sometimes you can find these enzymes online, but you have to watch out for something. Can you talk to
us? Yeah. So if you have histamine intolerance and you're looking for supplements that can help you, if you just Google histamine intolerance and supplements, you'll come up with a wide variety of options. But just a word of caution, because some of the things that I've seen promoted online to help with histamine intolerance, the supplements don't actually contain any diamine oxidase, and that is really what you need. There's some vitamins B6, vitamin C, probiotics, that can be helpful as well, but you really need the enzyme diamine oxidase to break down histamine. So you have to buyer beware, because there are companies that are, you know, marketing things out there that I think are probably not going to be very helpful at all. So you want to look, the one that I take, as I mentioned, is the Umbralex DAO, which anyone wants to write that down. It's U-M, as in Mary, B-R-E-L-L-U-X, UmbralexDAO.com. And so you can check that out. You know, I have a confidence in that one because it is medical grade and it's researched and, you know, I'm a personal and professional experience with it. So that's a good one to take. Also, you want to consider strategies to support good digestion. So probiotic supplements can be very helpful by improving your levels of beneficial microflora. That's something to consider as well.
You know, when you talk about, so many of the allergies and the environmental changes that are taking place, I was shocked when I found out, this came up at a conference I was at last year in Italy called Terra Madre, which is a slow food international conference. And they were talking about wheat and the food allergies, associated with wheat or celiac. And prior to, I think, the 1990s or 2000, all wheat was grown, or the majority of wheat was grown in Italy. They were the biggest producers, and from Rome and south. And Sicily was the biggest producer. And now Canada is the biggest producer of wheat. And, you know, the Sicilians were like, how are they able to do that? You know, they have a very cold climate. And it turns out that they spray, after they harvest, they spray the wheat with Roundup. And that helps it dry quicker, because it's the drying of the wheat that takes so long. And so
that's scary.
Yeah. So the wheat produced in Canada and any place north of the climate line of Rome, that's what they do, just dry the wheat quicker. And so it really makes you think, you know, are people really having this reaction to the wheat? Are they having the reaction to the Roundup? Because the Roundup's not then taken off the wheat. It's sitting on there, you know?
Now, I'm curious about this because I understood that Roundup was banned in Canada a while ago. I'm Canadian, and so I'm like, this is very interesting to me. Now, possibly after it is harvested and maybe it's sent to the States or something, maybe it's, or I don't know, unless there's an exception where farmers are able to use Roundup. But I do know that like homeowners can't use Roundup on their lawns to kill things or in their gardens. I've heard of people going over to, I live on the border, and I've heard of people going to Buffalo, New York to get it. But I'm not sure, maybe there is an exemption. Maybe farmers are allowed to use it, which would be very scary. Yeah.
I'll look into it, let you know. And you can look into it too, but that's what I heard, you know, and maybe Roundup is just, you know, the name that they're using for it. And there's another generic brand that's not called Roundup that they're allowed to use. I don't really know, but.
Yeah. And I've heard too, from people that have gluten intolerance that have said to me, you know, when they go to Italy, they are able to eat some gluten and they don't, or like breads and things like that. And they don't have the reaction that they have in Canada. So you wonder, why is celiac becoming so prevalent? I mean, today it affects like 1 in 100 people, whereas when I was diagnosed in the 80s, it affected 1 in 5,000. So it's certainly become much more common. Yes, we're better at diagnosing it. But yeah, it's interesting. And same with this histamine intolerance, becoming so common. So, you know, just really rates are skyrocketing. And, you know, there is a thought that the environmental impact, the fact that we're ingesting all these horrible chemicals that is affecting our digestion and our body's normal enzyme release, that may be at play.
And my guest today is Sherry Torkos. And we were just talking about histamine intolerance, which is something that I'm sure many of you haven't heard of, because I hadn't heard of it. But Sherry's also written quite a few books, and so I wanted to talk to her about her books. I'm particularly interested in Saving Women's Hearts. Can you talk to us about that book and some of the others that you've written?
So Saving Women's Hearts is a collaboration. I teamed up with a friend of mine who is a cardiologist, Dr. Martha Galati. We met at McMaster University. We were going to school together studying natural sciences, and she went on to medical school. I went on to pharmacy school, and years later we got together and we were just talking about the issue of heart disease in women and the fact that it's often an unrecognized threat. I mean, the medical community is aware of it, but when you ask most women what their biggest health concern is, most women are more concerned or thinking more about breast cancer and some of the reproductive cancers, not as worried about heart health. And yet heart disease is our number one killer and number one health threat. And so we were really passionate to collaborate and put together a book that, you know, would educate, would empower women, talk to them about both the medical side of things and the natural holistic side of things. And so this book, Saving Women's Hearts, is a collaboration of the efforts between the two of us to put together a comprehensive book specifically written for women, by women, all about this issue of heart health and heart disease prevention. And so we write about our recommendations from nutrition to supplements, you know, medications, the benefits, the risks, exercise, which is something that we're both very passionate about. Martha and I are both big fitness enthusiasts, and Martha's actually done research specifically on women and exercise and cardiovascular disease. So yeah, you can check that out. Electronic versions are now available, so you can get that at Amazon. And I have all of a lot of links to my books on my website, sherrytorkos.com, so you can check that out as well.
Mm-hmm. What recommendations specifically, diet-wise, do you recommend for women to do to keep their heart healthy? And do you recommend a supplement, or do you think you can do it all through diet?
Well, I think a diet, it's always important to try and get the majority of your nutrition from diet, but let's face it, we can't get everything from diet always. And when you have specific factors, whether it's cholesterol, blood pressure, other things, you may need to look at supplements, and if that fails, medication. But from a dietary perspective, we talk about, you know, the importance of eating a plant-based diet, which I'm sure you're an advocate as well. I heard you talking about vegan and vegetarian recipes and in the show opening, and you know, we're not anti-meat, but both of us, Martha's a vegetarian, I'm practically a vegetarian, and you know, there's a lot of evidence out there on the benefits of, you know, consuming a plant-based diet, getting back to our roots, back to nature. And you know, if you're concerned about hormones and chemicals in food, certainly there's a lot of that in meat today, unless you're choosing organic, free-range, hormone-free meat. So we advocate for a plant-based diet, in particular, lots of nutrient-rich berries and peppers, and we talk about, you know, vegetables that can help with lowering different risk factors for heart disease. We even talk about, you know, some of the indulgences like chocolate and why chocolate is actually good for heart health, especially the dark high, chocolate. Yes, exactly, the high dark chocolate, if you're looking at 70% or more of the dark cocoa, free trade, all natural is the way to go. Yeah, so we are fair trade, I should say, not free trade, fair trade. Yeah, so we love that, and green tea, and we talk about some of these recommendations we have for fitness and stress management. Now, women today are under just tremendous amounts of stress, and when you look at the research, it appears that stress has a more profound effect on women's heart issues than men. Men handle stress differently. And this is kind of borne out in the research that, you know, we have some unique factors there. And given that women are under so much pressure because we are still the primary caregivers and for most of our families and extended families, we are also very active in the workforce, and the demands upon us are tremendous. And we might think we can do it all, and we're great at multitasking at most times. However, that stress is something that is identified now to be a significant contributor to our hearts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, and natural medicine, I know you wrote the Canadian Encyclopedia of Natural Medicine. Was that also on your own, or was that a collaboration as well?
That was on my own. I did two editions with that book, and that was a lot of work went into that. It's a health encyclopedia where I discuss conditions from A to Z, and it's the Canadian encyclopedia, but really the advice in there is applicable to Americans or anybody in general. My publisher wanted the more Canadian angle, so hence the title. But yeah, so whether you have issues with arthritis or diabetes or menopause or prostate issues, heart health, PMS, you name it, I cover it all, and with a unique perspective in that I go through both the conventional medical approaches for a condition, so what medications, surgeries, things like that are typically offered or done, and then also what you can do from a holistic perspective, from nutritional interventions to supplements and things like that.
Mm-hmm. You know, for many years I've you know, through Slow Food Again, and I'm friends with Ellen Kamai, who's also a radio host on the Progressive Radio Network, and she's an herbologist. And mm-hmm. I've taken
I know Ellen.
You know Ellen. Great.
Yes, we've met at conferences, and I've interviewed with her before as well. Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've taken these walks with her and made concoctions with, you know, white pine needles and nettle and, you know, all the different things, mugwort, and you know, all the different things that you find growing just wild that are so good for us and that can be used in a medicinal way. And, you know, it's fascinating. It's fascinating. There's so much to learn. Where does one start, though? It's just mind-boggling.
It is. Yeah, it's totally mind-boggling. But, you know, it's important for people to realize that most of the 75%, I believe it is, of the medicines that we have today either come directly or indirectly from plants. And before the pharmaceutical revolution, before we had penicillin and codeine and all these drugs, we used plants. That was our primary mode of treatment, plant-based medicines. And, you know, we used to go to ancient healers and medicine men and women, you know, that were getting roots and berries and herbs and things that they grew and concocted and put together to make remedies. So, you know, it's interesting how we've kind of gone full circle. We went from that point in time to the pharmaceutical revolution to the discovery of all of these drugs and then kind of the discounting of the natural medicine with the, you know, thousands of drugs that have come out in the past 100 years or so. And then now today, I mean, I certainly see a lot more people are interested in going back to natural medicine and trying it. I think there's more awareness about the dangers of prescription drugs. Certainly, we hear on the news more and more about, you know, the risks and the consequences when drugs are taken, sometimes not even just inappropriately, but sometimes even taking them as prescribed, as recommended, there can be real consequences. So, in my course of career over the last 25 years that I've been practicing, I've noticed a big change in attitudes and perceptions and how people are embracing and using natural medicine.
Mm-hmm. I remember when my first daughter was born, you know, she was prone to earaches and, you know, she had quite a bit with, you know, of times where she was on antibiotics. And then by the time my second and third was born, I had learned so much. And I just remember one of the biggest discoveries, and I don't remember who actually turned me onto it, was, but for an earache, you know, I started to grate ginger and squeeze the juice through cheesecloth and mix it like 1 teaspoon of olive oil with 1 teaspoon of the ginger juice. And you warm it up a little bit and you put that in their ear and the ginger just pulls out whatever was in there. It's just amazing. Neither of my other kids had to go on antibiotics or have problems with earaches. And I've shared that remedy with so many different people and it works unbelievably like a charm. And my pediatrician started giving that remedy out to her patients. And it was incredible. My pediatrician was very open and, you know, started learning a lot from some of the remedies that I had picked up along the way and started sharing.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. No, it's great. I mean, when you look at that issue of antibiotics in children, unfortunately, too many parents will run to the doctor or the pharmacy and get the prescriptions right away. And sometimes they're necessary. I mean, you don't want the child to, you know, get a rupture in their eardrum and lose their hearing over a severe infection. That needs to be treated. But if you get it early on, there are certainly natural things that can be done to help preempt it. You know, when we look at just the use of antibiotics, the overuse of antibiotics, there are some serious consequences with respect to resistance and how it can affect their digestive systems for months after the antibiotics are even finished.
Mm-hmm. So can you share with us one of your favorite natural remedies?
Okay, let's see here. Oh, I have so many. Well, let's talk about one. This time of year, people are sick with colds and flus during the winter months. And one of my best remedies for a cough or a sore throat is honey. Just a nice dark amber honey, which is very soothing to a sore throat. It actually can help speed healing. And interestingly, in some of the studies, they found honey to be just as effective, if not better, than dextromethorphan or DM, which is the common ingredient in a lot of cough syrups. So I love honey. You can also gargle with salt water, another home remedy that's just so simple and easy to do. It actually helps to reduce inflammation, helps to speed healing. Gargling with salt water is also very effective as a nasal irrigation solution. A lot of people use neti pots, or you can use just a saline nasal spray if you're not comfortable doing the neti pot. But it's a great way to get rid of the mucus and clear out your sinuses versus using the decongestant sprays or medications, which have a lot of side effects. So those are two things. And then, you know, for immune system support this time of year, I'll recommend people make sure they're getting enough vitamin D, vitamin C. Echinacea can help. Garlic, I like kyolic, which is an aged garlic extract. That's good for immune system support as well to kind of fortify your system with during this time of year.
Honey and salt water, those are like they go back to your mom. I think they're way back, you know, making me gargle with salt water or honey. And really.
It's tried and true. And, you know, when you have a child too that has a sore throat or a cough, you know, the cough medicines, they taste horrible, but yet most kids will love a teaspoon of honey. They'd be thrilled to have a teaspoon of honey. So I think that's, you know, definitely something to consider, and running your vaporizer to keep the indoor air moist if you have little ones that are congested or coughing, because the dry air can worsen those symptoms.
Mm-hmm. So are you a proponent of the neti pot? I've heard mixed things about it.
Yeah, I think the neti pot can be very helpful, but it's not so practical for a lot of people. Getting the hang of it is difficult. Just the concept, some people don't like the idea of swishing something through their sinuses. If you're not comfortable with it, I would just use a saline nasal rinse as another option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I've heard, I like the neti pot, but then somebody said, oh, it's not good for you. You know, it can spread, you know, any infection you have throughout your whole system.
But there's no way it can spread infection. You're inserting it into one nostril and the solution's coming out the other side. You're just flushing out your sinus cavity. It's not spreading infection. I've never heard of that, although.
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. It didn't seem like it made sense to me, but you know, I didn't really know. So I thought, oh, perfect person to ask.
Yeah.
Okay. So cough, sore throat, honey, salt water, anything else? Medicinal foods.
Oh, favorite medicinal foods. Okay. I have so many. I mean, I love berries, garlic, green tea, oats and oat fiber for blood sugar control, weight management, cholesterol management. Oats are fabulous for that, as well as chia seed. I love chia seed. Using it in recipes as a egg substitute, or to add more fiber or moisture to your recipes, especially when you're baking gluten-free. I bake gluten-free banana breads or different cookies. I always dissolve some chia seed or mix chia seed with water, and it kind of absorbs all that water.
Oh, so you use chia seeds the same way I use flax seeds.
Yeah, and flax seeds are great too. But I love chia because it has higher omega-3, and it also has a lot of protein and a lot of antioxidants. So yeah, I just love chia seed. That's one of my favorites. I'm just trying to think of other medicinal foods. I'm just yogurt and kefir. Love that. My son, you know, he has his yogurt drink every morning. We do a lot of berries. We make our own smoothies and shakes, things like that. I think are just fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to jump back a little bit to the food allergies, since that's so much of your specialty. What other food allergies do you think, we didn't really talk about like the FODMAP, you know, people that have the leaky bowel or those kind of allergies. What's your experience with that? Do you have any suggestions for other allergies and things people can do?
Yeah, I think, you know, that there are just so many food allergies that are affecting people today. And I guess, you know, kind of what I would encourage people to do is, rather than stabbing in the dark, if you suspect you have a food allergy or a food intolerance, it's a good idea to speak to a dietitian, a holistic practitioner. Sometimes doctors can be helpful as well, or even just to refer you to have some testing done, because it's just amazing how what an impact a food intolerance can have on your system. I mean, allergies, when you think of allergies, usually people will get obvious reactions, like they eat something, then they get a rash or hives, or in a worst case scenario, there can be an anaphylactic where their airways are shutting down and their blood pressure is skyrocketing, and that can be, you know, really, really dangerous. But with a food intolerance, they can be more tricky, because whether it's gluten or lactose, Lactose histamine. Tends to be more, histamine. Lactose is, you know, sometimes easier to pinpoint because you have dairy and you get gas, bloating, or diarrhea. Histamine is trickier because with a histamine intolerance, you can have digestive symptoms, but then you can also have the congestion, the runny nose, the watery eyes, the racing heart, the flushed skin, the headaches. In fact, like I've talked to so many people that have migraines, they cut out the red wine, but they think it's because the sulfites in the red wine, yet the amount of sulfites in wine is actually less than the amount of sulfites in dried fruit, like dried apricots and things like that actually have more sulfites than wine. So sometimes people will blame it on the sulfites. And I think that's where, you know, my advice when it comes to food intolerances is sometimes what we think may be bothering us may not be the case. And the whole sulfites is a very good example where people will give up their red wine thinking it's the sulfites when in fact it's the histamines. So, you know, doing an elimination diet is helpful. Also, if you check out that website I mentioned earlier, daodeficiency.org, if you go to daodeficiency.org, there's a self-evaluation survey that you can do, and that can help to guide you in determining whether or not you have histamine intolerance.
Now, when you do an elimination diet, how do they know what the, you know, they might be able to tell what food is triggering something, but how do they know what the what it is in that food that's bothering you, like whether it's a histamine or the sulfur or something else?
Well, that can be tricky. So when you're doing a an elimination diet and you're trying to determine if you have histamine intolerance, you should do this with a dietitian or a holistic nutritionist, where you're really identifying, you know, all the foods that have the high to moderate amounts of histamine, getting them out of your diet, and then gradually reintroducing one food at a time to see what the reaction is. So it is not an easy process, I will say that, but you really do need to work closely with a professional. The other suggestion I have, which tends to be easier for people, is to do an enzyme trial where you take an enzyme before you have any high histamine foods, see if that helps. If you feel better after you, say, take your enzyme, have your glass of wine, your pizza, your beer, whatever it may be, if the symptoms are not present or reduced, then you know that most likely it was due to a DAO deficiency.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. And as a holistic pharmacist, now, do you work in a pharmacy?
I work very part-time in pharmacy. I used to work full-time, and then when I had my son, I have a 7-year-old now, I stepped back, and I only work very part-time in our local community. And I also still do some, I do a lot of writing for different publications. And I do media interviews, as you know, this, like that we're talking about today. I really try to, you know, raise awareness through interviews in radio and television on various health topics. And I'm toying with the idea of doing another book. We'll see. It's much more difficult now that I have a very active 7-year-old to see whether or not I can fit that into my life. But you know, I try to keep my hand on the pulse of what's happening in both the pharmacy and in the whole health area.
Yeah. So just wondering, you know, as a pharmacist, do you see sometimes, you know, doctors prescribing things and you might have a different opinion, or do you not get involved in that at all?
Oh, like, yeah, I do get involved in that.
I think it would be so hard, yeah, if you, well, you know, have a certain belief system and you're seeing these doctors just like, you know, giving out the opioids or the, you know, antibiotics, just like they're, you know, you know, little candies.
Yeah, and you have to be careful. We do regularly, pharmacists will intervene, will contact a doctor if a patient has an allergy to something they've prescribed, if there's a drug interaction, or even if when we're talking to the patient and reviewing the benefits and the risks of medication, if we don't agree with it or we think that there's a problem, it's not in the patient's best interest, then that's my obligation to contact the doctor and see if we can hold off on the medication, give the patient something else, do a trial first with a natural product and see if we can get results there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that always concerns me. And I wonder, you know, it's like with the amount of medications that doctors put, put especially older patients on, and because everything's a specialty now, very often doctors barely even know. I mean, you fill out the form, what other medications are you on, but they don't really, there's no way to really know how all the different medicines interact with each other. I mean, how can they possibly test all those different scenarios?
We don't know. The doctors don't know, and the pharmacists don't always know. But we do have very good computer systems today where we're inputting a new prescription, and it can alert us to a potential interaction. But what we have to take that information, so say you're prescribed an antibiotic and you're already on a certain cholesterol-lowering medication. Well, the cholesterol medication can affect your liver enzymes in a certain way that if you take the antibiotic with it, it could be a problem. So we have to look at what the potential risk is, mild, moderate, or severe, and then how are we going to advise the patient to go forward? Maybe it's holding your cholesterol medication for the week that you're on the antibiotic. Maybe it's choosing a different antibiotic or things like that. So we really have to, it's an individual situation, but you know, you're right. There are thousands and thousands of potential interactions with drugs, drugs and other drugs, even drugs and foods, drugs and supplements. So it's hard to know. There's no definitive answers that will, you know, I shouldn't say that. There are some cases where we know particular combinations of drugs can definitely be problematic. And then there are other ones where we have to use our judgment and say, well, this could happen. What is the likelihood? You know, how could this impact the patient?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would think that's really scary. You know, I mean, I get very nervous when I see people on so many medicines, and I'm thinking to myself, how can they possibly even know what they really feel like? I mean, when you're taking so many different things, what's the real you feeling like, you know?
That's right.
Medicines.
Yeah. That's right.
And then, you know, because I also know people that, you know, take medicines for bipolar or whatever, and they very often don't stay in compliance because they don't like the way the medicines make them feel.
Yeah, and that's a challenge, especially with a lot of the medications that we use for mental health disorders, whether it's bipolar, depression, or schizophrenia. The side effects of those medications sometimes can be just as worse as the condition.
Yeah, it's so hard. Wow, Sherry, it's so interesting. Thank you so much for joining me. We're just about out of time, so can you share again with everybody listening your website and how they would get in touch with you and your books, et cetera, so that they can learn some of what you know?
Sure. So you can check out my website at sherrytorkos.com. It's SHERRYTORKOS. There's information on my books, and I have a blog that I posted on the topic that we were focusing in on today, food allergies and intolerances. So you can check that out. And links to my books are there as well. And on Facebook, I'm at holistic.sherry. So you can check me out there. Yeah, thank you so much.
And please let me know when you're going to be in New York. Maybe you, I and Ellen will get together and see each other.
I would love that.
In person. And everybody who's been listening, thank you so much. Please enjoy the rest of your holiday season. Have a wonderful, wonderful new year. And I wish you all the best going into 2018. And may we find peace in the world. So have a great rest of the week, everyone. See you again next week. Thank you, Sherry. Bye, everyone.
Thank you.
Sure. Bye for now.